Oh, you in the back, you can wake up. No. Okay. That's kind of... I wanted to cover a topic that might no longer be a topic because, as you know, or maybe you've heard, but in November, there are supposed to be new revisions to the Novus Ordo. How many have heard of that? I don't mean to be beating a dead horse, but I find it interesting that after 42 years, they're now going to say, the better translation is for many. And that's been in the air for more than a year. But they continue to use for all. As you know, we had an individual here who was coming up to the Mount in Buick in 2007 who was working on some of the sisters. That's what led to that little break in 2007. And he was promoting what was called the short form for the consecration. This is my body. This is my blood. And that's what he thought. That's enough. Now, what he based his argument on was the Catechism of the Council of Trent. And in this catechism, he mistranslated the words consist of with contained in. See, the catechism says the form of the consecration of the bread is this, the form of the consecration of the wine is this. The form of the consecration of the wine consists of these words. And it gives, you know, the whole form. Hic est in calic sanguinis mei, etc. All the way to in remissionem peccatorum. And he was saying, no, it's not consist of, they are contained in. So even though this gives the whole form, he is saying, this is what they really meant. This is my blood is contained in. And that was the big argument. He gets into all this, you know, accusative this and ablative that and all this Latin stuff. Interesting, there is a Dr. Alexander Brill. Do you know him? From Australia? Never heard of him? But Dr. Alexander Brill is a philologist. He knows Greek and Latin inside and out and backwards. He's a doctor. He has a doctorate in these languages. And he said that this individual, this gentleman, had a serious deficiency in Latin and the workings of the Latin language. And he says, these are the words, consist of. And he also goes on to show that if you take the word in Latin and you find other references how it's used in the Catechism of the Council of Trent, it can only mean consist of and not contained in. Regardless of all that, I'd just like to get to a number of points on the short form, long form issue. Number one is St. Pius V. In the Roman Missal, you'll find in the front of the Missal what we call the De Defectibus. And it talks about defects that may arise. And when it gets to the form, it gives the entire form, all the words that are used in the Missal. And it says if there's any alteration or change that changes the meaning, the consecration is invalid. Besides that, St. Pius V had to deal with a Cardinal Cajetan. Cardinal Cajetan was a Dominican theologian who said the short form was good. That's enough. What did St. Pius V say? You have to delete that from your treatise. You can't say that. The other thing with regard to St. Pius V is this. When it comes to the Catechism of the Council of Trent, it not only gives the entire form for the words, saying consistent, it gives the entire form, but then later on it explains the form. And it explains all of the words For this is the chalice of my blood, the new and eternal covenant, the mystery of faith, shall be shed for you and for many unto the remission of sins. It explains the entire form. And it also has explicitly, with reason, where the words for all not used. That explicitly is taught in the Catechism of Trent. St. Thomas Aquinas in the Summa says you can't use the words for all. St. Thomas says you have to use the entire form. Now, there were theologians who said, yeah, this short form is probably enough. Yeah, probably enough. But in theory, only. In practice, you could never use that. You don't say, this is my body, this is my blood. Oh, it's probably enough. Mass is done. No. When it comes to a definite end to be achieved, as you study moral theology, you cannot use probabilism when it comes to the sacraments. You have to use that which is certain. And that's the reason why even St. Alphonsus Liguori says, some say you have to use the entire form, some say the short form. He says, in practice, you have to use the entire form. And if a priest were, perchance, to use the short form, he would be obliged to repeat the consecration and say the entire form. He'd be obliged to do that. So this whole discussion will probably become obsolete because they're going to go back to for many. But this is what I wanted to share with you. Are they not clever? They waited 42 years. They had this invalid form for 42 years. And now that most of these older priests are dead, and the younger priests are being ordained, supposedly ordained by consecrated bishops who are not consecrated because of their altered form. And I think, did Father Casimir cover that? Okay. Father Casimir covered the issue of the consecration of bishops, the altered form. So these priests are not priests. And now we're going to come back to the many. Isn't that nice? I mean, really, really clever. So I wanted to share a couple of things with you about cleverness. We know that Satan is the master of deceit, master of deception, and the more I study Vatican II, how they brought about the changes, I'm thinking, that's not only smart, that's real smart, that's not only clever, that's extremely clever. And to me, it's so clever, it's almost supernatural. And I'm not saying angelic, I'm saying demonic. That the devil knows exactly where and what to do and how to do it and how to present it and how to destroy the faith, but counterfeit things and cover his tracks. And that's something that we look at Pope Leo XIII in Satis Cognitum. He's talking about the unity of the church. Pope Leo XIII, and he says the most dangerous of errors are those who, like a drop of poison, destroy the faith with just a couple of drops of poison. They're very, very clever in to show, like, oh yeah, we believe this, and no, we haven't changed that, and we're not that radical. We're just trying to update things. We're trying to bring things up to modern times. But very, very subtly, drops of poison bringing about the destruction of the faith. One of the areas that comes to my mind is this issue of religious liberty. This is one of the most controversial decrees of Vatican II, called Dignitatis Humanae. Very clever, because when they started out with something that was true and then went to something that was false. They start out by saying that man is free from coercion. You can't force anybody. You can't force somebody to become a Catholic. You can't force somebody in the faith. And that's true. You can't. But although there's this freedom from coercion, that doesn't mean that they have freedom to promulgate, spread heresy, false religions, etc. And this was the meat of the matter with Dignitatis Humanae. The Catholic Church had condemned what we would call these false liberties, these supposed rights And what a right is a moral power that a person has to possess something or to do something. It's based on law and ultimately the laws of God. And among these is this supposed freedom that you can worship God any way you want and nobody can prohibit you from doing that. And this is what was the downfall of Catholic countries. If you look at like Spain and like some of the Catholic countries of South America, what the Masons couldn't do, what the communists couldn't do, Vatican II did. Spain, as a Catholic country, had this law. If people immigrate to Spain and are not of the Catholic faith, they will not be disturbed in their belief. Nevertheless, they are prohibited from the public expression of their faith and proselytizing, you know, spreading the faith, etc. It's not going to be allowed. They have no right to publicly promote their false church or their false religion. That was in the 1950s. 1967 comes along. Dignitatis Humanae has already been decreed back in 1964. The Spanish government says, you know, in recognition of the teachings of Vatican Council II, Spain grants religious liberty, freedom of cult to everybody. And Spain went from being a Catholic country to a divorce, because Protestants believe in divorce. Hey, that's what they believe. They believe, they don't believe what Christ said, what God has joined them together, let man, no man's put asunder. Protestants believe in divorce or remarriage. So divorce, and then contraception, and then abortion. And now it's you've got issues with homosexuality, and it's not a Catholic country anymore because of this freedom. And what if somebody wants to worship Satan? Or let's say somebody, they think pornography is fine, or they think whatever they think. And these once Catholic countries went right down after Dignitatis Humanae. But how cleverly, if you read the decree, their freedom from coercion, they can't force anybody, now they're free to do this and that, and nobody can stop them. They have the right to do that. In fact, I'd like to share with you very briefly, there was a fellow who got a master's degree in theology, some Catholic Vatican II, you know, university. He came to Omaha to try to want to convert me, etc., etc. And we went back and forth and back and forth. I said, listen, enough. So I got out the Syllabus of Error by Pope Pius IX, and then I got out Dignitatis Humanae. I had them side by side. I said, okay, we have here one and the other. The Syllabus of Error contains all these condemned propositions, one after the other, and explicitly condemns this issue of, you know, religious liberty, explicitly. Then I read from Dignitatis Humanae where it says it must be established in governments as a constitutional right, and they have the right to proselytize and spread the value of their religions and this and that, whatever else. I said, reconcile this with this. Yes, no, tell me right now. You reconcile this to me. I knew he couldn't do it because by admission, in the preface of Dignitatis Humanae, they even admitted they couldn't do it even in 1964. The preface to Dignitatis Humanae, it says that the transition between syllabus and Dignitatis Humanae will have to be explained by future theologians. We can't explain it. How the church condemned it in 1864, and I apologize, this was 1965. So 100 years, almost to the date, 100 years later, and we have that right there. How are we doing on time? When do I have to stop, or how far can I keep going? Okay. I want to share another thing with you. You know, I'm not a person that is all concerned about dates and, you know, things, this, that, whatever, but it's remarkable, like Syllabus of Error and 100 years later, Dignitatis Humanae. Another very remarkable thing is this, with regard to Pope Pius XII. Pius XII, in the 1940s, issued this apostolic constitution, Sacramentum Ordinis. Did Father Casimir talk about this? Okay. What Sacramentum, I'm getting too fast here, Sacramentum Ordinis, he was determining the matter and the form for the diaconate, for deacons, priests, and bishops. Now, why did this come up? Interesting controversy between theologians. In the Latin Rite, we obviously have, for the matter, the imposition of hands, but we also have what we call the handing over of the instruments, the traditio instrumentorum. Now, in the Council of Florence, when they were reconciling these schismatics, they were instructing them, they were taking right out of the Summa, right out of St. Thomas, about, you know, the rites of the church, the matter and the form, etc., etc. And it was stated that this was the matter for the sacrament of holy orders, the handing over the instruments. The controversy came up with this. In the Western Church, the Latin Rite, get this right here, this handing over the instruments is there, but in the Eastern Catholic Rites, they don't have that. Eastern Catholic Rites, they did not have hang over the instruments. So they were asking, are these orders invalid? Or was there a mistake made here? Pope Pius XII, very providentially, very authoritatively said, listen, the church has no authority over the substance, the matter, and the form. Christ instituted these things. And he said, according to the mind, the Council of Florence, they were definitely aware that the Eastern Rites Catholics did not have this, Traditio Instrumentorum. But Pope Pius XII said that if, because of a prescription of the church, this was an added necessity for validity in the Latin Rite, he said, what the church can prescribe, the church can also rescind. And he says, from now on, the imposition of hands is the matter of the sacrament, the diaconate, priests, and bishops. And he also went so far as to talk about the form. It's an amazing thing, but he comes out with Sacramentum Ordinis. 20 years later, Paul VI is tampering with the form for consecration of bishops. And sometimes you can see this pattern. Pope Pius XII talked about a mystici corporis Christi, about the mystical body of Christ. The one true church of Christ is the Catholic Church. So many years later, very shortly after that, Vatican II comes out. No, the true church of Christ subsists in the Catholic Church, meaning it's not just the Catholic Church is the true church of Christ and the one true church of Christ is the Catholic Church, but no, the true church of Christ exists beyond the boundaries of the Catholic Church. Very, very interesting how you see how clever the devil was, how clever Satan was in doing these things. Another thing, real briefly here, it's with regard to the decree on ecumenism. Now, we have to go back because, you know, ecumenism has become such a widespread practice. But in those early days, in those 60s, obviously there's some people who had enough Catholic sense to know that this was wrong. So how did they get around this? We talked about the principles for the practice of ecumenism. What are the principles for this practice of ecumenism? They said that ecumenism must not be done indiscriminately. So, you know, in the 1960s, well, hey, you know, trying to hold the line, you're trying to be conservative, you know. Clever deceit of the devil. Number two, it says it depends on two principles. One principle is the unity of the church. It has to express the unity of the church. And the other principle is that it has to signify a sharing of graces. Now, this is where it gets ambiguous. You mean the Catholics are sharing the graces with the non-Catholics, or is it mutual? They don't say. And it goes on to say, because of the unity principle of the Church, this principle almost always rules out ecumenism. The idea of, you know, Catholics getting together with other churches and other religions. Nevertheless, the needed graces recommends it. What a bunch of double talk. It depends on principles. And this principle almost always rules it out, but go ahead and do it anyway because of the needed grace. This was just a token thing to calm people down. Like, you know, I'm looking at this. There's something for everybody here. If you're somewhat conservative, you're going to say, well, look, they said don't do it indiscriminately. But if you're a liberal, you're going to say, but the needed grace recommends it, and it always recommends it. You give them that little leeway, but, you know, where have we come in the last 40-something years? They're practicing ecumenism with everybody and anybody. And that's why we have the slideshow up here that we're going to get into. But I'd like to end on one last thing, and that is, we're going to touch on this in the next portion. It is with regard to God's providence. And maybe I should just save this when we should show the slides. But God in his providence has prepared us for these times in which we live. The popes prior to Vatican II, they were aware of these elements. Liberalism, modernism, religious indifferentism, ecumenism, all these isms, they were very much aware of them. And they were teaching faithfully the deposit of faith, what the Catholic Church teaches. So if we look at the teachings of Pius IX, Leo XIII, St. Pius X, Benedict XV, Pius XI, Pius XII, we have therein the things that should give us that solid security that, hey, we're not, even though we're small in numbers, and even though they have the buildings and they have all the exterior, we have the faith.